crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigall. Thank you very much for joining me today. A couple of apologies at the beginning of the show. Number one, for my voice, I am a little bit under the weather, so you might it might sound like I'm a little bit more nasally than usual, and that is because I am. We might also hear some random angle grinding taking place in the background. That's because next to me, which once was a vacant lot, is now a structure going up, and they've decided that this is the hour this Sunday that they are going to cut the reinforcement bar with the angle grinder. So that might come in and out of it, in and out of the recording. I also apologize for not being with you last week, last Sunday, and not producing a program. I was actually out last Sunday touring a visitor we had in town from Scotland. I was touring the Ophel excavation area and also the City of David, the Palace of David, the area around the Gihon Spring. We got to walk through Hezekiah's Tunnel, of course, as well. And so I wasn't in the office, although you will be the beneficiary of that visit today, because I am going to talk about David, King David, that is, the monarch that ruled over Israel back 3,000 years ago and ruled from Jerusalem 3,000 years ago. The Bible says that this man was a man after God's own heart. And I think one area in which we see this characteristic, or why he might be described as such, is because of his love for this city, his love of the city of Jerusalem. Now, we take it for granted that Jerusalem is God's holy city, and that it's always been that way, and that there was a ready amount of knowledge anciently that Jerusalem was God's chosen city. And yet David is the one that moved the capital there. David is the one that set it up as the political capital, the spiritual capital. He's the one that wrote about it in all the Psalms. And so that everyone after David seems to really know how important Jerusalem is as the city of God, the future capital, the millennial capital of God as well. But in the Bible before King David, there's not too many mentions of Jerusalem. Why is that? So today we are going to look at David's love for Jerusalem and how he set it up as being the place of Israel's focus. All of Israel after David was to focus on Jerusalem, and he made that so. But first of all, I do want to go back to the first mention of Jerusalem in the Bible, because we do see traces of David's love for Jerusalem stemming back to this original encounter of Abraham with the king of Salem. Now, this is the first time that Jerusalem is mentioned in the Bible, and it's found in Genesis chapter 14, and I'm going to read verses 16 to 20. And this, again, is during the time of Abraham. He's just rescued his nephew Lot from the Assyrian kings that had taken Lot and a lot of other goods and spoil from this region. They had just come down and ransacked the region, including the king of Sodom's area and a lot of other towns they took over. And so Abraham took his men, and they chased them all the way up to the north of Israel and even into Syria, and defeated them and brought Lot back. But notice when he comes back, he doesn't just go back down to where he came from, south of Jerusalem. He visits Salem on the way. This is verse 17. It says, "And the king of Sodom went out to meet him," that is Abraham, "after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him at the Vale of Shaveh," the same as the king's vale, "and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God." The priest of God the Most High. "And he blessed him, and he said, 'Blessed be Abram of God Most High, maker of heaven and earth, and blessed be God the Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand.' And he gave him a tenth of all." And so here you've got Abraham going back after this victory. Obviously, this victory was God-inspired, and he's paying a tithe, 10% of what he got from that victory to Melchizedek, this king that was king of Salem. And he is also priest of Salem also. It says here he's the priest of God the Most High. And so here we have Abraham, out of whom all the biblical promises would stem, and out of whom Israel, Jacob, would come, and then the 12 tribes of Israel, one of which was the Levites, that the priestly line would come through, as we've talked about on this program, and also even the kingly line that David would come through, coming through Judah. Both of those were one of the two of the tribes of Israel. And yet we have Abraham, who was obviously more important than all of those tribes, given that all the promises came through Abraham. He's paying homage to this Melchizedek, a priest of God. So obviously this office that Melchizedek holds, this king of Salem holds, obviously trumps anything that comes from the bowels of Abraham, the family line of Abraham, since Abraham knew to pay him tithes. And so it's really interesting here. There's not much mention more of this Melchizedek as far as when the time that he was alive. Abraham doesn't mention him again. The book of Genesis don't mention him again. So there's obviously much more that took place for Abraham here, who already had established a relationship with God, to know to pay tithes to this man, this king of Salem, this Melchizedek. Of course, Melchizedek means king of righteousness. Melchi or Melech and Tzedek is righteousness. And so that's what his name means, king of righteousness. And we know from excavations that have taken place in the city of Jerusalem that we have remains from that time, from Melchizedek's time. If you ever tour the city of David, and again, if you want a tour, I'd be happy to give you one. Just you can email us or email me at letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. And I'll be happy to give you a tour if you're in the vicinity at any time. You will see as we go into the Gihon Spring, going to the Spring Chamber, just before that, we see a massive fortification with massive stones that are encircling the spring. And those stones are from the Middle Bronze Age, the same time period as Abraham. And therefore, Melchizedek, remember, this was a city during the time of Abraham, and we have physical proof of that. This and just massive physical proof of that. Yes, it's not widespread, because again, we're going back now 3,500 years ago or more, and some of it's obviously been destroyed by other construction. But around this spring, it remains. It's still there, and it's massive. And so that's really just inspiring to visit that and see those stones and see how large they are and see that it's there protecting the Gihon Spring as well, which is probably significant also. So outside of Melchizedek here being in Jerusalem, we don't really have too much mention of Jerusalem for a while as far as the biblical narrative goes. We do have a mention of the land of Moriah in Genesis chapter 22, where it discusses Abraham, the patriarch, being told by God to sacrifice his son Isaac. He doesn't obviously go through with it. God tells him to stop before he kills him. But this takes place in the land of Moriah, as the Bible says. People traditionally would put that sacrifice, that almost sacrifice, taking place on Mount Moriah, but that's not what the Bible says. It just says it happened in the land of Moriah. Moriah, of course, is this general area around Jerusalem. There is one other mention of Moriah in the Bible, and that takes place in the book of Chronicles, where it discusses King Solomon setting up an altar of sacrifice on Mount Moriah, and so that's when the specific mount is mentioned. But since we know that this was a city during Abraham's time, the city of Jerusalem was a city, and that Mount Moriah is so close to the actual city, it doesn't really stand to reason logically that Abraham would pick a spot, or God would tell him to pick a spot right by the city where Melchizedek is. I mean, like right by, within eyesight of the city itself. That's not the, if you read through Genesis 22, that's not the type of context that you get from the type of scene you get from the context. Nevertheless, we do have Jerusalem being mentioned a little bit later during the time of Joshua and then the judges. Obviously, Joshua does not take the city. But right during the beginning of the period of Judges, it seems that it does fall, Jerusalem does fall into Israelite hands, and then falls back out of Israelite hands into Jebusite hands. And it would remain that way for the next 300 years. And so you've got the Abraham's time, you have a king who is also a priest, who is the king of peace. He is that Abraham's paying tithes to, so obviously a very important figure. He is king of Jerusalem. And then we have this intervening period where Israel is not really, or doesn't control Israel at all. It's the Jebusites that are there, and the Bible isn't clear on their connection to Melchizedek. But then all the way through those hundreds of years, Israel isn't controlling this really important city in terms of location, in terms of the fact that it's right in the middle of the heartland of the Promised Land. Jerusalem, Jebus, as it was called. And we don't have King Saul taking it. We don't have the other, during the period of the Judges, anyone else taking it. So for hundreds of years, you've got this Jebusite town right in the middle of where the Israelites are crawling around. The Israelites are establishing their new nation. And it's not taken. Why not? Why not? If it was so known as being this city that God had chosen through Melchizedek, if there's a priest of the Most High God that Abraham's paying tithes to in Salem, that's an important city. And yet it isn't taken. And by taken, I mean taken into Israelite control. Now, it did have some massive fortifications. It seems that the Jebusites did benefit a lot. So that might have been the reason why the city wasn't taken in those intervening years. But it is a city that takes on extreme importance as soon as David is made king. David knows of the significance of Jerusalem, and it is priority number one for him to take Jerusalem and set it up as the capital of the nation. Now, why did David do that? That's the million-dollar question. I think it speaks to a lot of why God called David a man after his own heart. And we're going to discuss more about that when we get back from the break. Don't go away.
This is Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive. Thank you for listening.
Hello and welcome back. We're looking at King David and his establishment of Jerusalem as the center of everything in ancient Israel. It's interesting, as we covered in the first part, that David knew that God wanted to establish Jerusalem, not just as the capital of the nation, but also as God's eternal capital. There's not a mention in the Bible about that until we get to King David's time. David knew that God had chosen Jerusalem. Jerusalem also was known as Zion, and then the fortress of Zion that was taken by David and his men became known as the City of David. So these are terms that are pretty much synonymous. The Bible records this history in 2 Samuel chapter 5. It's a really critical chapter to understand what happens and what's going through David's mind as he becomes king over all of Israel. I'm going to read through a portion here so that you can get the chronology and see how quickly it was that David decided that Jerusalem needed to be the capital. Again, it was the first thing that he did after being made king over all of Israel. Notice here in chapter 5 and verse 1, it says, "Then came all the tribes of Israel." These are the northern tribes. Obviously, David was already king over the southern tribe of Judah at this point, since he was of Judah. "Then came all the tribes of Israel to David unto Hebron," the capital of the nation of the tribe of Judah, "and spoke, saying, Behold, we are your bone and your flesh. Also in times past, when Saul was king over us, you was he that led out and brought in Israel. The Eternal said to you, You shall feed my people Israel, and you shall be a captain over Israel." And so they finally fess up and understand that David was meant to be king, not the dynasty of Saul, not a Benjamite, but it was going to come from the tribe of Judah. Verse 3, "So all the elders of Israel," again the northern tribes, "came to the king to Hebron, and King David made a league with them in Hebron before the Eternal, and they anointed king over Israel," the northern tribes. Verse 4, "David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah." So notice that he is now king over what we know as the United Monarchy, all the tribes of Israel united under one king. Verse 6, what does he do next? The king and his men went to Jerusalem. That's what they did. I love it. He's made king. Next verse, let's go and take Jerusalem. The king and his men went to Jerusalem unto the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, which spoke unto David, saying, except you take away the blind and the lame, you shall not come here, thinking David cannot come here. Now, this translation is a little bit more difficult. It basically means they were saying that even if the blind and the lame were defending this city, you would not be able to take it. You can't take it, David. That's what the Jebusites were saying. Nevertheless, even though they said that, verse 7, David took the stronghold of Zion. The same is the city of David. So the stronghold of Zion, there is some debate as to what that exactly means. Many believe the stronghold of Zion is the entire ancient walled city of Jerusalem that was from Melchizedek's time, basically. The same is the city of David, and that indicates that it was the whole thing, not just the northern, very northern part of the city of David, but the whole thing. So he renames it the city of David. Verse 8. And it discusses how he makes this, how he conquers it. Verse 8, and David said on that day, whosoever gets up to the gutter, or the Tsinor, and smites the Jebusites, and the lame and the blind, they are hated of David's soul. It's a lot in italics here, so it's very difficult to try and understand exactly what it means. Then it continues here in verse 8, wherefore they said, the blind and the lame shall not come into this house. Verse 9, so David dwelt in the fort, called it the city of David, the same fortress of Zion. And David built round about from Millo and inwards. An inward, geographic term to describe a feature of the northern part of the city of David. Verse 10, and David went on and grew great, and the Eternal of Hosts was with him. And Hiram, king of Tyre, sent him messages to David and cedar trees and carpenters and masons, and they built David an house. And so notice this. He's made king. The first thing that he does is take Jerusalem. He takes this fresh city, the city that had not been taken over at all since the very early reign of the judges and had been in Gentile hands, basically, for the next 300 plus years. And so he then takes the city. Then what does he do next? You can see it goes on to talk about how builds his palace, the very next thing. Then after that, chapter 6, it goes into the fact that he wants to grab the ark. He goes in to grab the ark. Now, Samuel mentions the construction of the palace before the retrieval of the ark, but Chronicles actually mentions the construction of the palace of David after firstly attempting to retrieve the ark. So it's possible that they kind of happened at the same time, which really does indicate that David not only wanted to establish Jerusalem as the political capital of the nation, but also the spiritual capital of the nation. You remember in the time leading up to David's reign, the ark was in Kirjath-Jearim. It went to the Philistines when Eli and his sons, or at least his sons, took the ark into battle. Then it was lost to the Philistines, and they didn't want it because it was cursing them. They tried to pass it on to their five different cities, and eventually it made its way back on into Israelite territory, but it wasn't in Jerusalem. It wasn't at Gibeah where the tabernacle was at this point. The tabernacle is no longer at Shiloh. And so David's made king of Israel and Judah, first of all makes a political capital move there, and then also at the same time grabs the ark. He wants to draw everyone's attention to Jerusalem. He doesn't want the attention to be divided between a couple of places, a political and a spiritual capital. He wants them both to be the same. So what does he do? He goes up and he grabs the ark. Eventually he does it the right way. We know that he doesn't do it the right way the first time. And then a few months later, he goes and grabs it again, and he brings it up correctly, and he puts it right by the Gihon Spring, right by where we have these massive remains from Melchizedek's time. That's where he brings the ark initially. He places it in a tent, as it says there, by the Gihon Spring somewhere. And hopefully we can find that location at some point as well. But you've just got to look behind the story, the history here. I mean, there's nothing in the Bible to say, and God spoke to David, go, David, take Jerusalem. And God spoke to David, go, get the ark and bring it to Jerusalem. The Bible just says that David did it. Now, obviously it was inspired by God in every way, but this is, you know, God working on the mind of King David, the man after God's own heart. He understood the importance of Jerusalem. And it looks like he understood that going back all the way to Melchizedek's time as well, as we'll see. And so you'll notice if we keep on going in the chronology here, I'm just going to jump over to the parallel account over in Chronicles. In 1 Chronicles 16, verse 1, it says, "So they brought the ark of God and set it in the midst of the tent that David had pitched for it, that is, by the Gihon, and they offered burnt sacrifices and peace offerings before God." And so you also had this altar of sacrifice that was there in Jerusalem. And if you read the end of this chapter, there is also the tabernacle at this point in Gibeon. And so you had the ark there in Israelite territory at Jerusalem, but it was separated from the tabernacle itself. Of course, the ark was inside the tabernacle until the time that Eli's sons had taken it out. And then it was out of the tabernacle all through King Saul's reign up until this point. And still at this point. And so David sets up this musical procession before the ark at this new tent, separate from the tabernacle at the Gihon. But notice chapter 17. And this is just a stunning chapter that, again, we get another impression about David's heart and how he understood the importance of Jerusalem as being the capital politically and spiritually of God's nation. He wanted the people to look not only to the kingly line at Jerusalem, but he also wanted to look to Jerusalem, for that was the location of God's rule on earth. God's rule on earth would come from this city. Now notice this, we're going to go back to 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 1. And it says this, "And it came to pass, when the king sat in his house, and the Eternal had given him rest round about from all his enemies, that the king said unto Nathan the prophet, See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells within curtains." There's something wrong here, David thought. I've got a beautiful house, but the ark of God is in curtains right by the Gihon spring. Verse 3, "And Nathan said to the king, Go, do all that's in your heart, for the Eternal is with you." And yet, in the very next verse, God actually comes to Nathan and reveals that he doesn't want David to build him a house. Verse 5, "Go and tell my servant David, thus says the Eternal, shall you build me a house to dwell in? I've not dwelt in any house since the time that I was brought up the children of Israel out of Egypt, even to this day, but have walked in a tent and in a tabernacle. In all the places wherein I have walked with the children of Israel, spoke I a word with any of the tribes of Israel, whom I commanded to feed my people Israel, saying, Why build you not me a house? Have I asked anyone to build me a house? Have I asked any of the judges, as it's talking about there, to build me a house? I haven't in all those years. Now therefore, so shall you say unto my servant David," he's still talking to Nathan here, to tell David, "thus says the Eternal of hosts, I took you from the sheepcote, from following the sheep, to be ruler over my people Israel. And I was with you whithersoever you went, and have cut off all your enemies out of your sight, and have made you a great name, like unto the name of the great men upon the earth. Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and I will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own, and move no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more as before time, and as since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and have caused you to rest from all your enemies, and the Eternal tells you that he will make you a house." So this passage here is incredibly interesting, because it starts out with David wanting to build God a house, and Nathan hearing it saying, good idea. And then God telling Nathan, no, you go back, tell David that he's not going to build me a house. In fact, I haven't asked anybody to build me a house. I've been content, really, in this tabernacle. And here David comes along and says, wow, there's something not right about this. I really want to build God a magnificent edifice to dwell in. And God ends up saying, well, no, you're not going to do that. But instead he says, David, I'm going to make you a house. I'm going to make you a house, David. Now, why are these two things linked? Obviously, I mean, you know, God, it wasn't going to be David that would build God a house, a permanent structure, the temple that would be built by his son Solomon. And yet, God announces that he is going to make an eternal covenant with David. This is known as the Davidic covenant, that his house or his family, same Hebrew word, Well, house can mean family. Bait can mean family, or it can mean house. God wants to make God, David wanted to make God a house, and God says to David, I'm going to make you a house, and I'm going to make your house established, be established forever. The Davidic kingly line, that promise to David here, that there shall never lack a man of David to sit on the throne of Israel forever, leading right to the Messiah, that, and the Messiah coming out of the bowels or the genealogy of David. That's always going to be the case. There's always going to be a son of David on the throne for all eternity. That promise, that covenant came out of, it seems here, or it's contextually, it's right after David's desire to build God a house, a permanent house in Jerusalem. You can see this here in verse 13. It says, and he shall build me a house, that is Solomon, my name. Interesting, Solomon's name and root is very similar to Shalem, or peace. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I'll be his father and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I'll chasten him with the rod of man, with the stripes of the children of men. But my mercy shall not depart away from him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before you. What do you mean took it away from Saul? Well, God cut off Saul's dynasty. It's not going to be that way with David. I will correct him with the stripes of men. I will punish him if I have to, but I'm not going to take away this dynasty, this kingly line. It's always going to be David, David's sons on the throne. Verse 16, and your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you, and your throne shall be established forever. And so what a beautiful chapter here, God acknowledging David's desire to build him a permanent structure in Jerusalem. And eventually, Dave, obviously, through this, God says, well, a temple is going to be built. And other passages show that David wasn't allowed to build the temple because he was a bloody man. He had blood on his hands and Solomon hadn't. And so he was going to be allowed to build the temple. It would be built. David's motivation here, there was nothing wrong with it. And God said, because of that, something happened in the mind of David, that because of that, I'm going to make him an eternal house. I'm going to make this kingly line come from him. David, a man whose heart was just like God's, who sinned for sure. And they're recorded in the Bible also. But his heart was right in this instance. He really did want to honor God. He really did want to establish this city, or reestablish, really, this city of Jerusalem as being the city of God. And as he did so, God said to him, your kingly line that comes from you will dwell in this city. And it will dwell in that city eternally, obviously, once the Messiah comes. So let's get back to this question. How did David know to do all of this? Established Jerusalem, political, spiritual capital, wanted to build a temple there. He was obviously motivated by something. Obviously, God had to reveal to David the centrality of Jerusalem in his plan. That would have been the case. But we also get indication that David fully understood the importance of what took place earlier on in history in this city. David understood the importance of Melchizedek during the time of Abraham. Now, it might be a surprise to you, but the only other time that Melchizedek is mentioned here in the Bible here, in the Tanakh, it is mentioned in Psalms, Psalm 110. That's the only other place it's mentioned. And let's just go ahead and read that. And it is a dynamite chapter in every way. And it's a chapter that so many do not understand today. They don't. Notice it. This is a Psalm of David. It says here, the Eternal said to my Lord. And that just there is dynamite. You have here David's Lord, that is my Lord, which is obviously God, and you've got another God, it says here, speaking to my Lord. Two beings that make up the God family, Elohim, a plural form of God. Why? Because it is a family, there's more than one. And that's what David understood. The Eternal said to my Lord, or God said to my Lord or my Master, sit you at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. So this is amazing here. You've got a God, David's master, sitting at the right hand of his master, the master of David's master. Who was David's master? David's master was God. And here you have someone in authority of that God. Clearly there are two beings here, in authority over David. God, then it says, shall send the rod of your strength out of Zion, rule you in the midst of your enemies. This isn't talking about David. This is talking about the Messiah's rule. And the Messiah there is this, my Lord of David. Verse 3, and your people shall be willing in the day of your power, in the beauty of holiness from the womb of the morning. You have the dew of your youth. The Eternal has sworn and will not repent you. That is David's Lord. Still talking about David's Lord. You are a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek, after the rank of Melchizedek. I find it absolutely amazing that David understood this, that David knew this, that Melchizedek had a very much a connection, had a connection to the rule of the Messiah, David's Lord. Melchizedek, there in the city, when Abraham paid tithes unto him, obviously indicating the higher office that this being had over Abraham. And here David is setting up Jerusalem as the political and spiritual capital of the nation, and he's the one that brings up Melchizedek. He understands how important that history is. Melchizedek and his rulership and leadership over Jerusalem was the very reason why David wanted to establish that city as the capital of Israel. And the very reason why David wanted to move the ark there, the very reason he wanted to build the temple there, he knew this was God's city. And so David, this man after God's own heart, he builds up Jerusalem. It's a central focus of his entire rule. And because of that focus, likely one of those reasons that he had this focus, God decides to make him a house. He gives him the kingly line that the Messiah will eventually come from and rule from this very city. And then after this time, I mean, you read through all the book, through the book of Psalms, and you'll have mentions of Jerusalem, Zion, the city of David, the mountain of God, Mount Zion, and how this is God's city. David trumpets that through all the Psalms, but you won't read that. You won't read that earlier on in biblical history. It's just not there. But the Psalms are full of it. And then after the Psalms, the prophets just take a hold of this vision and run with it. Isaiah, Micah, Zechariah, obviously Haggai as well, all writing about Jerusalem's importance and Jerusalem's place and how it's going to be attached to the throne of David forever and how that is where the Messiah will rule from. That's where God's truth and God's law is going to flow out of. That doesn't happen. You don't read those scriptures until David here really does set it up so beautifully in the Psalms. And even if you go ahead and read the book of Chronicles, Chronicles was written after Ezra, in the post-exilic period. That's written after Kings. That's written. It writes about all this history that took place during the time of Ezra, at a time when there were many, there were the Samaritans in the north that were saying Jerusalem wasn't the capital, Jerusalem isn't important. And Ezra says, hang on a minute, it's extremely important. This is a city whose builder and maker is God. And it is the city that the world is going to focus on through eternity, as God's rule will come out of that location, as it did during David's time, where it's going to obviously supersede what happened during David's time. But David's time and Solomon's rule was just a type of that, a type of the rule that was going to come from Jerusalem. And you read the book of Chronicles, and Ezra is just reconfirming this fact over and over and over again. He wrote that book right when the throne wasn't even there. I mean, the throne was gone by Ezra's time, and Ezra was back there in Jerusalem. Nehemiah was there. Zerubbabel was there before him. Zerubbabel was actually of the royal line. He was a prince of Judah, one of Jeconiah's own. And yet he didn't have the throne because God had moved it elsewhere. Part of Jeremiah's commission was to move the throne elsewhere when Jerusalem fell. And yet when those returnees come back and the throne's not there, Ezra is talking about the throne and how inextricably linked it is with the city of Jerusalem. Why? Because that's where the throne's coming back to. He understood the connection between the throne and Jerusalem, just as David did. He understood the connection with Melchizedek, of course, just like David did also. And he drew attention to that fact. It's really interesting. You read some accounts in the book of Kings that was written earlier, and obviously Chronicles parallels that account. But you look at the number of times that Jerusalem is mentioned in Chronicles compared to Kings. Ezra wanted to make sure of the fact that people understood that Jerusalem was important, that Jerusalem should be the focus, along with the throne, of course. But it was the throne at Jerusalem, and that is where that throne is going to return to. I want to finish today's program by quoting Psalm 132. This is a psalm that summarizes David's desire to reaffirm Jerusalem as God's chosen city, both physically and spiritually. And David talks about this. Well, David didn't write the psalm, actually. It could have been written by his son Solomon or someone else. But it certainly shows David's urgency at creating this capital city, or recreating the capital of Jerusalem, to be the city of God. And it shows the future of this city also. Notice verse 1, it says a song of degree. This is likely one of those psalms that was sung as people did ascend to Jerusalem. Lord, remember David and all his afflictions, all his difficulties, how he swore unto the Eternal and vowed unto the mighty God of Jacob, surely I will not come into the tabernacle of my house, nor go up unto my bed. I will not give sleep to my eyes, nor slumber to my eyelids, until I find a place for the Eternal and an habitation for the mighty God of Jacob. And so it's just amazing. David, at this point, he's like, as we covered, I'm not even going to let sleep come to my eyes until I go find that ark and make a habitation for it, somewhere for it can where it can live. Verse 6, lo, we heard it in Ephratah. We found it in the fields of the wood, or that is Kirjath-Jearim. We will go into his tabernacles. We will worship at his footstool. And then verse 8 says this, arise, O Lord, into your rest, you and the ark of strength. Let your priests be clothed with righteousness, and let your saints shout for joy. For your servant David's sake, turn not away your face from your anointed. This is the part of the prayer that Solomon made right when he was dedicating the temple as it was constructed. And it's included in this psalm also. David found a place of rest for the ark, a habitation for it. Then it continues, it talks about the scepter promise, this promise of David. Verse 11, the Eternal had sworn in truth unto David, he will not turn from it. Of the fruit of your body will I set on your throne. That's what David told him. They shall sit on my throne forevermore. Verse 13, for the Eternal has chosen Zion. He has desired it for his habitation. And then it actually quotes God in the first person. And so you just capture this again. It's summarizing all of it. Psalm 132. David wanting to build God a house, or establish the ark there with a house. And then this Solomon's prayer of God being able to come into his rest, into that temple. And then reconfirming the Davidic covenant, how one of David's is going to be upon the throne. David's sons will be upon the throne forever. And then God says this, verse 14. This is my rest forever. Here will I dwell, for I have desired it. I'll abundantly bless her provision. I'll satisfy her poor with bread. I'll also clothe her priests with salvation. Her saints shall shout aloud for joy. There will I make the horn of David to bud, and I have ordained it a lamp for mine anointed. His enemies will I clothe with shame, but upon himself shall his crown flourish. That's talking about Jerusalem of the future. This hasn't happened yet. Notice the connection. This is God's rest forever in this city. Here he is going to dwell in Jerusalem. Heavenly Jerusalem is coming to this earth, and it will be located in the same location that David set up and prepared the temple before. This is the same city that Melchizedek built and made at the time of Abraham. This is God's city. And David chose Jerusalem in a very practical manner, choosing it as a political and spiritual capital of the nation, putting everybody's focus on this city. And God really supported that in every single way. And therefore, when you read about the future prophecies that are going to take place when the Messiah comes, they're inextricably linked to Jerusalem. There is so much hope in studying both into the history and prophecy of this city, and also the history and prophecy of the Davidic line, the Davidic throne. And they are connected. They were connected in a sense. Obviously, David wasn't around yet, but Melchizedek was there as over, as king and as priest. And then David wanted to draw attention to that fact also, that they were going to be united in Jerusalem, and they're going to be united again, and again really soon. If you'd like to understand more about Jerusalem's future and how it's connected to the events of the present as well, you can request our booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy. It was written by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry. That's all I have time for today. Thank you very much for listening in. If you'd like to send your feedback, you can do so by writing your emails to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. I'll talk to you next week.